From the Land Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the closing market report for the 26th day of January 2017. I'm Todd Gleason out of the office today. A couple of things that are different about the program. First, no update of the commodity markets because I'm traveling in the western part of the state and unable to get information back to you directly. Secondly, because we had Mike Zuzulo on yesterday at his request, he wasn't available for tomorrow, and I'm traveling today and really didn't want to talk again with Dan Zwicker before the end of the marketplace and thought it might be more fun to have a whole week's worth of trade under his belt before we got to him this week. We'll do that tomorrow. Also, we'll talk about dicamba soybeans today. Are you putting those in your field this year? Do you really know what the risks are? Well, we're going to talk about that with Aaron Hager. He's with me over in Printons right now making this presentation you're about to hear. We'll have a really good discussion. So you should stay with us. Oh, and if all goes as I think it should, we'll check in with a broker from Argentina, too, and see what the crop looks like there today.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Again, I'm traveling in western Illinois with Aaron Hager today, so no update of the commodity markets. However, Aaron was in my office, and we had a quick discussion about dicamba soybeans. The first thing I asked him was to explain what he thought the most important pieces of the dicamba-resistant soybean puzzle might be for farmers.
We really encourage farmers, if they're considering using a dicamba-based system in soybean in 2017, to spend some time reading the labels of the products that are registered for application in these particular varieties. We really want people to be aware, can you actually feasibly make these applications within these label restrictions and guidelines? And if you can, then we can have a pretty good conversation about where we really think that this technology is going to fit in terms of helping us manage some of our wheat populations around Illinois.
Here's one of those interesting restrictions. Today, it's not possible, says Aaron Hager, to spray dicamba on dicamba soybeans in a tank mix.
There are no approved herbicide tank mixes with these two dicamba formulations that can be used in the dicamba soybean. So in other words, by this restriction on the label, you would have to make one application of dicamba and then literally turn right around, fill up the tank with whatever herbicide or whatever other pesticide that you need to make an application, and then go across the field a second time. There's a chance that that could change by the time that the application season rolls around here for 2017, but folks really ought to be aware that there's no guarantee that that will happen.
That's Aaron Hager. We'll have a complete discussion with him about dicamba and dicamba-resistant soybeans coming up in this edition of the Closing Market Report.
Agricultural programs are made possible by Risk Management Commodities Incorporated in Lafayette, Indiana, Chalmers, Indiana, and Hudsonville, Illinois. Risk Management Commodities focuses on managing risk in today's complex and sophisticated commodities market. 866-837-9027.
Let me take a moment now to thank you for listening to our ag programming. Thank you for listening to the programming. And just as a reminder, here's what you hear each and every business day. We start at 8:55 a.m. with the opening market report, including Aaron Curtis, Pete Manhart, Bill Gentry, Ellen Dearden, and Bill Mayer. And then an update at 10:58 a.m. with five other voices, Joe Vaklovic, Greg Ginder, Merrill Crowley, Chip Nellinger, and Steve Georgie, followed up at 12:58 each and every business day with Sue Martin, and then, of course, the closing market report, including our analysts Kurt Kimmel, Wayne Nelson, Jackie Vakes, Dan Zwicker, and Mike Zuzulo. And we wrap up each week by recording Commodity Week on Thursday evening. You can hear it at willag.org that night or on Friday afternoon at 2:36. Oh, and don't forget that we also have a whole series of regularly scheduled analysts during the closing market report for weather. Those include meteorologist on Monday, Mark Russo, Tuesday, Don Day, Wednesday, Drew Lerner, Thursday, Mike Tenora, and on Friday afternoon, both Jim Angel and Eric Snodgrass.
Agricultural programming on WILL is made possible by Farm Credit Illinois. Since 1916, Farm Credit Illinois has been helping farm families succeed, providing farm real estate and operating loans, crop insurance, and point-of-sale financing. Farm Credit Illinois joins in celebrating the rich history of Illinois agriculture.
I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. It's the 26th day of January 2017, a Thursday afternoon. I'm out of the office this afternoon. We'll talk with Dan Zwicker. It's Zwicker Consulting, by the way, tomorrow on the Friday edition of this program. Tune in then to hear him. Today, we're going to start off with a wholly different subject as I'm traveling this afternoon. We're talking about dicamba soybeans with Aaron Hager, weed scientist at the U of I. Aaron, thanks for being with me. First, can you give me some history of dicamba? How long has this product been around?
Well, I believe the original discoverer, the holder of the original patent for dicamba was a company called Velsicol. And if I remember correctly, I think it was first patented, I think, back in sometime in the early to mid-1960s. Commercialization, I believe, was either late 1960s or 1970s across, I guess, most of the corn-growing areas of the U.S., certainly a compound that was originally developed for use in corn and in other grass crops such as, you know, pasture areas and things such as that. So material really that's been around for a long time, extensively used in various formulations in crops such as corn here in Illinois for many, many decades. And now the dicamba-resistant soybean is now a technology that would potentially expand the use of dicamba into soybean, which just so happens to be a crop that in a non-transformed or non-GMO state is still extremely sensitive to dicamba.
How sensitive is that crop to dicamba?
It's one of the most sensitive broadleaf species that's grown in Illinois. You can look in the literature and find studies that have been done now for 40 or 50 years really trying to look at how sensitive soybean are. You know, the take-home message is that, recent work out of Missouri, I think down to a rate of 1/20,000th of a field use rate, they were able to induce symptoms of exposure to dicamba. But we need to remember, of course, that even though we see symptoms, that may or may not always translate into an adverse affected yield at the end of the growing season, because ultimately, whether or not yield is impacted is going to depend on a lot of variables. Number one, of course, is what dose were the soybean plants exposed to. And another very critical element in this equation is at what growth stage were the soybean when this exposure took place. So we could literally have the same rate of exposure to dicamba in soybean at a early vegetative stage and see no effect at the end of the year. And then if we would take that same dose and expose the soybean at a much later growth stage, say at one of the reproductive stages, the likelihood of seeing an adverse effect on yield is then much, much higher and much more likely.
So we're likely to have this in, I suppose, a lot of soybeans across the state. People who are looking to control, in particular, mare's tail. That was a problem. It was a problem primarily for, I think, no-tillers, but last year that developed into a problem for everybody across the state.
Actually, we saw as many escapes of mare's tail and soybean farther north in Illinois in 2016 than we've ever seen before. Now, we have to admit that we really have not screened our mare's tail populations from Illinois to determine whether or not or what percentage of these plants are actually resistant to glyphosate, which is a very common component in many burndowns. But looking at the phenotype of these plants after they're sprayed in the field, they look almost identical to what we normally associate a phenotype of a glyphosate-resistant mare's tail plant. So we assume, of course, and this could be a fairly large assumption, that a lot of our mare's tail is now glyphosate-resistant. So a tank mix or a combination burn down that's been used for many, many years in Illinois, something like glyphosate 2,4-D, if the glyphosate is no longer effective, the 2,4-D by itself in these mixes is generally going to pretty much struggle with trying to control the mare's tail by itself. So dicamba, on the other hand, we've got a lot of data. Other universities has quite a bit of data also that would indicate that it can be a very strong material to control mare's tail and burn down ahead of a no-till soybean planting. With the dicamba soybean technology, this actually allows for the opportunity to use dicamba at a fairly good rate for mare's tail control, and we really don't have those plant-back restrictions that we do on other dicamba formulations that we need to adhere to before planting a non-dicamba soybean.
All right, so this is one of the big differences non-dicamba soybean versus the dicamba soybean. And it sounds to me as if this is a pretty good burndown product. You'd be okay with using it ahead of time. However, there are a lot of label restrictions. Once we get in season, that change everything, especially if you're going to spray this onto a dicamba-resistant soybean.
Actually, some of these label restrictions even do cover the pre-plant or pre-emergence timing as well. You know, we'll give one example. If we're looking at like the Roundup the Extendamax label, which is a straight dicamba formulation from Monsanto, if there's a requirement to have a buffer area, a downwind buffer area, the size of that buffer area would vary depending on the rate that's applied. So an in-crop application of up to a half a pound of dicamba acid would require a 110-foot buffer. However, if we're using dicamba now in this pre-plant or this pre-emergence time frame, if we're allowed to go up to a full pound of dicamba at that application, well, if we do that, now that buffer goes to 220 feet. So these restrictions on the label, there'll be restrictions not only in the in-crop application, but certainly some that would extend also into the pre-plant or pre-emergence application timing also.
There's only one nozzle that can be used for dicamba application. Is this post and pre-emergence both?
That is correct. The supplemental label that governs the use of dicamba with a dicamba-resistant soybean, there is only one nozzle that is approved for use. That could change in the future. But folks need to really be aware that going into 2017, there is only one right now.
Yeah, and approved means not recommended. It means approved.
It means approved. And I've heard conversations of people who have gone through these labels, and I've heard them say, well, we recommend this nozzle, or we recommend this boom height, or we recommend several things. But these are not necessarily recommendations. These are restrictions on the label. When I think of a recommendation, it's me giving somebody a piece of advice, and they can choose whether or not they want to follow that advice or not. These statements on these labels are not recommendations. These are things that must be followed every time these applications are made. So, for example, if you elect not to follow something like the nozzle selection type or the height of the boom above the crop canopy, you are now violating this federal law, this federal label.
Is it the height of the boom above the crop canopy or above ground level?
Be above the crop canopy.
Yeah, so it says 24 inches. So, but normally, when the crop's in the field, at what height would you be spraying?
It's going to depend on your nozzle spacing as well as the angle of the nozzles, but usually you're in that 24 to 36 inch range.
Yeah, this is low.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a lot lower than applicators would normally go. Probably a lot lower than most farmer applicators would go, right? So this is going to cause a problem, and they have to go slow too.
Yeah, there's even maximum application speeds that are listed on the label. I believe you cannot exceed, I think it's 15 miles an hour during the actual application. You know, a few other things that come to mind that maybe not everybody's aware of. If you have precipitation in the forecast for the next 24 hours, you're not allowed to make an application. There's concern about if we make the application, if some comes in contact with soil, for example, if we get into a heavy rainfall event the day afterward, we may physically move some of that out of the field through the process of soil erosion and have it deposited in an area that could be harboring an endangered dicot species, for example.
And then there's the whole volatility thing, which relates to how well this drifts. And it's going to be a problem. Already has been a problem.
Well, and we see a lot in the farm press, we hear a lot from the manufacturers about low volatility formulations, whether it be the Roundup, or I'm sorry, the Extendamax with the Vapor Grip or the Ingenia. And, you know, one thing to remember, even though these products are low volatility or what the companies claim have reduced volatility, that does not mean there's no volatility. And that's something that folks really need to be aware of. These products can have the potential, and they do have the potential, to still volatilize. And volatility is something that is very, very concerning, because really once that material changes from a gas to a vapor, it literally can move wherever the wind's going to move it to.
And there's an inversion restriction as well.
There's inversion restrictions on there as well. You're not to make an application under conditions of inversion, which are typically occur under very low wind speeds. Many times they'll begin late in the afternoon or early evening and extend until the early morning hours. So even, you know, for example, about how important inversion conditions can be, one of the label restrictions would say if the wind is blowing, if there's no wind at all, if winds are calm, you're not allowed to make the application.
I read the label, the supplemental label, and this is the one for dicamba soybeans, if you're spraying dicamba onto dicamba soybeans. It clearly states that the applicator is liable, and it's not really anybody else. Does that happen in other labels for chemistries, or is this something that really is just a dicamba on dicamba resistant soybean label?
I think if you would ask someone with the US EPA who's responsible for the labels, I think most of the consensus would be the applicator is always responsible. They're the last person who makes the decision whether or not to release that material out into the environment. But there's even statements on these current supplemental labels for Xtendimax and Ingenia that really puts a lot of the emphasis around the applicator and their responsibility. For example, there's language that said the applicators are responsible to ensure they're not going to make an application where there's sensitive crops grow nearby, or that they need to consult a crop registry of sensitive crops in the area to know where they are in relation to where the field applications are going to take place. So, again, a lot of emphasis placed around the applicators, and ultimately they're going to be the ones who are going to be held accountable if there's off-target movement.
A lot of legal jargon in the label that's not normally there.
That's correct.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm. It will be.
It should be. And does it work? I mean, does this product really work very well?
Well, we've got 50 years of experience using dicamba. We've used it extensively in corn. I think a lot of folks who are old enough to remember the times when we were using it in corn has a pretty good idea what it will and will not do. It's been positioned, I think, in the marketplace now in the state of Illinois as sort of almost a cure-all, and it's not going to be a cure-all for every one of our weed issues that we have around the state. It's not going to be as good, it's not going to be as effective against, you know, pigweed species, for example, whether it be red root, smooth, water hemp, or palmer, as glyphosate once was before we evolved resistance in water hemp to it. I would use the adjective excellent to describe how effective that glyphosate was on water hemp before resistance evolved across our landscape. I would not use the same adjective for dicamba. It's good. Sometimes it's very good on water hemp, but it's not excellent. And if we think that using dicamba in dicamba soybean is going to take us back to an era where glyphosate was so effective it was literally hard to miss water hemp in our soybean fields, I think we're going to be sorely disappointed with the outcome in 2017.
Thank you so much. We'll, I'm sure, be in contact with you during the growing season to see how this progresses, not only here in the state of Illinois, but around the Midwest.
Okay. Thank you, Todd.
Aaron Hager is a weed scientist at the University of Illinois. You can read more from him on the Bulletin website at bulletin.ipm.illinois.edu.
Support for agricultural programs comes from AgriGold, celebrating their 13th year as a major corporate underwriter of Illinois Public Media's ag programming and e-newsletter. AgriGold's support allows their customers and growers everywhere to receive quality ag information at no charge. More information on AgriGold can be found at agrigold.com.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media on this Thursday afternoon. I'm U of I Extension's Todd Gleason, traveling again today with Farm Credit. We're in the western part of the state, down actually south of Springfield to begin with, near Carlisle at the Magnuson Hotel. And then at this hour, we should just be completing our presentations in Prentice, which is near Ashland in western Illinois. Here's today's agricultural news. A new study from The Ohio State University and University of Illinois shows the federal crop insurance program is meeting its statutory loss ratio obligation. In layman's terms, the program is performing as it was actuarially designed across the whole of the program with a loss ratio not to be greater than one. And the program protects farm revenues from in-year losses. The loss ratio for all covered crops over the period from 2001 to 2015 is 0.87. The primary covered crop loss ratios are as follows. For corn at 0.85, soybean 0.66, wheat 0.99, and cotton at 1.06. The Joint University study notes the statutory obligation applies to the entire program, but no violation is found for the three crops with the largest insured acres, corn, soybeans, and wheat. While the loss ratio is greater than one for cotton, it does not differ from one at any commonly accepted level of statistical confidence. Well, it appears Donald Trump is eyeing NAFTA as a way to make Mexico pay for the border wall, or at least that may be the deal at hand. For farmers worried about what a Trump presidency could bring, two of the main areas of concern are his campaign calls to restrict immigration and to renegotiate trade deals. In an interview last night on ABC, the president said funding to build the wall along the border with Mexico will eventually, quote, come out of what's happening with Mexico. We're going to be starting those negotiations, he says, relatively soon, and we will be in a form reimbursed by Mexico. This seems to have been a reference to NAFTA. Those renegotiation talks should be on the agenda next week when Mexico's president is expected to visit the White House. Well, more than 130 agricultural groups and companies wrote to Trump earlier this week to urge him to modernize NAFTA in a way that it safeguards the windfall successes the pact has provided for U.S. farmers, ranchers, and food processors. Mexico, by the way, is the second largest importer of U.S. corn behind Japan. Well, it's time to talk Farm Bill. Mark your calendars for the 23rd of February. That's the newly scheduled date of the Senate Agriculture Committee's first field hearing for the new Congress. It will focus on the 2018 Farm Bill and take testimony from farmers. Chairman Pat Roberts, home state of Kansas, will be the field, and Kansas State University's main campus in Manhattan, the place. Our producers have had time to employ the programs in the current Farm Bill, and they have a lot to say, Roberts, a Republican, said in a statement announcing the hearing. We need clear direction on what is working and what's not working in farm country, and we will be listening to see what needs to be adjusted. Again, the Farm Bill battle starts February 23rd. Well, let's stay in D.C., but move to EPA. What to do about WOTUS? Although EPA Administrator nominee Scott Pruitt hopes Congress steps in to deal with confusion around the scope of the Clean Water Act and says that if confirmed, he would withdraw the Obama administration's rule that he has sued over and replace it with one that is, quote, within the authority granted to EPA and the Corps. He, in written answers to the Senate committee overseeing his confirmation, argued the federal jurisdiction extends beyond the navigable interstate waters and into the tributaries that can transport pollutants to navigable waters. Pruitt did not explain how far up into the headwaters that reaches. And finally today, this tidbit from a grain trader at Congran SRL, located in Rosario, Argentina. Maria Moretta expects the recent flooding to cut soybean production to 52.9 million tons.
So we estimate that we could have a production about 52.9 million tons.
Moretta's 52.9 million ton estimate is well below USDA's current soybean production estimate of 57 million for the South American nation. Given the lower production because of rain-soaked fields, her expectations for Argentina exports of the oilseed remain high.
We think exports to China will increase this year because of all the mess that is happening in the United States.
Soybean harvest in Argentina starts in April and runs through June. And that's a look at today's agricultural news. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes with a look at the agricultural weather forecast with Mike Tenora.
Since 1985, Stuart Peterson has offered strategic commodity consulting and marketing services to help producers manage market opportunities and risks. The firm develops dynamic strategies customized to each client's goals and operation size. More information is available at stuart-peterson.com.
It's National Popcorn Day. It's also National Peanut Brittle Day. On this day in agricultural history in 1831, Heinrich Anton de Bary was born. A German botanist, he is considered a founder of modern plant pathology for his roles of fungi and other agents in causing plant diseases. In 1865, he proved that the life cycle of wheat rust involves two hosts, wheat and barberry. In 1838, the first state temperance law was passed in Tennessee. In 1861, Samuel Slocum died. He invented a machine to make pins with solid heads and a machine for sticking the pins in a paper holder for sale. In 1926, Francis Boyd was born, an American geologist. His studies on the origins of volcanic rocks contributed to the understanding of the formation of the Earth. And in 1932, William Wrigley Jr. died. He started out as a traveling salesman at the age of 13, selling soap for his father's company. He had a series of sales jobs.
Agricultural programming on WILL is made possible by Farm Credit Illinois, lending support to generations of farm families for 100 years. Whether a young farmer or a seasoned grower, Farm Credit Illinois offers financial products and services geared specifically to the agricultural community.
Agricultural history.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media on this Thursday afternoon. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. We're now joined by Mike Tenora. He's at T-Storm Weather in Chicago. Hey, Mike, thanks for being with us today.
You're welcome, Todd. Great to talk with you.
Mike, tell me a little bit about Argentina and the soybean crop there. We know that there were some really rough rainfall, flooding conditions early on. Things have dried out at this point. But what do we see in the way of production problems, in your opinion, and what do we look like going forward?
Well, that's a very difficult question to answer because we just don't have all of the information we need in order to start estimating production losses. That said, we do know some things. We know that there was approximately 12 to 17 inches of rain at official observation sites over about December 22nd through today. That is a lot of rain for that area because their summer climate is very similar to what we have in Illinois. So if you can imagine the entire state receiving anywhere from 12 to 17 inches of rain, with of course a few areas drier than that and a few areas wetter, you'd start to have some flooding problems, and that is what occurred. Now we do know that. Since then though, and since basically about a week ago, it stopped raining. It's been fairly dry and we don't have a whole lot of rain on the immediate horizon. Now, that does start to change once we get into Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday of next week. We'll start to see thunderstorms roam the region, and some of these real wet corn and soybean areas will start to turn wetter. The big question is, how wet will they end up? Well, we don't have a real great idea on that at the moment, except to say that near normal rainfall is likely within the first week of February. There's two or three storm systems that will move across the country. Any one of those will produce some thunderstorms. And just based on a probability forecast, you have to assume that one or two of these would hit some of these wet areas, giving you, again, at least near normal rainfall, which would be around 1 to 1.5 inches in the first week of February. Now, if anything were to go wrong, rainfall totals would be much higher, and that's why we need to watch this, because every single time we've had a chance for thunderstorms over the last 4 weeks, the thunderstorms have exceeded expectations by producing heavy rainfall.
From Argentina, let's move to Brazil. What do conditions look like there?
Well, Brazil is a little bit of an interesting situation, as it normally is this time of the year. But a lot of the northern soybean areas of Brazil were unseasonably dry from early December through about the middle of January. Over the last 10 days, though, it started to rain, and it's rained a lot. It continues to rain even today. We'll see more rain over the next couple of weeks with the remnants of several cool fronts lingering within northern areas of Brazil. So basically the pattern there has turned wet. They start to harvest soybeans at this time of the year in Mato Grosso, which is the number one production state. So these rains will probably limit harvesting rates in the near term, with the big question being, how long will this pattern last? Well, we feel pretty confident that it will last in some form for at least the next 2 weeks, with a large-scale drying window fairly unlikely for the time being. So we need to keep an eye on that, because also keep in mind, Todd, that after we harvest these soybeans, we start to plant the second crop, corn. So any delays in harvesting result in delays in planting. And so that'll be something to monitor through about the first 10 to 14 days of February.
Hey, thanks so much, Mike. We appreciate you taking the time with us today.
You're welcome, Todd. We will talk next week.
Mike Tenora, of course, is with T-Storm Weather. He is in Chicago, Illinois. I'm UofI Extension's Todd Gleason.